outside the box of religious obligation lies a road less travelled, into the heart of the father's affection. Slinging freedom all over the place, this is the God Gene.
The
God Gene.
The God Gene. A three for again.
Yeah. Well, we left with the cliffhanger of there are biases everywhere.
This is part two. This is not really a third one. This is just part two of the last one.
There we go.
So it's still the same early day in March as we do this. So those of you that moved on, maybe the world blew up by now and we're not commenting.
I don't think so. That'd be your negativity bias.
I'm not saying it will. It's my just world hope. Once it does, God will make it what it is.
Wow.
Okay, so we've covered belief bias, self-serving bias, groupthink, negativity bias, optimism bias, pessimism bias. We already commented about the reactants. You'd rather do the opposite of what someone else is trying to make you do. Isn't that just the flesh, man? You're trying to make me do something. I may even want to do what you're trying to make me do, but then I'll not do it.
You know, it's interesting. I was talking to somebody, and you can just tell. It's like their biggest frustration is this person that they love, they want to change. And it's like, if that person would only change, everything would get better. And I'm looking through this going like, eh, probably that's not the reality that's going on there. Because, you know, you think in terms of, it's easy for us to look at someone else's life and you're like, well, they just need to change there. And it's just easy for us to kind of think that. And it's like, if they could and it was so easy, they probably would have. I think for most of us, we're kind of like standing on the edge of a cliff and it's like, look, if I wasn't frightened of this or if I thought I had the ability, I would have done something here. But the reason I'm standing here and I'm kind of frozen is I don't know what to do. And so just coming with your hands behind my back and pushing me towards that which I don't – nobody likes that. So in terms of the bias that comes out, it's like I just think we've got to love people to a different space.
I love this. Is when we feel our liberty is being constrained, our inclination is to resist. However, in doing so, we easily overcompensate.
Mm.
And the fix, be careful not to lose objectivity when someone is being coercive or manipulative or trying to force you to do something. Wisdom springs from reflection, folly from reaction.
That's good. That's a mouthful. That's good, though.
So just because someone's forcing you to or trying to doesn't mean it's not a good thing for you.
Right.
You just be reactive.
Right.
Which I tend to be. You go up to somebody and you push them in the chest, they almost always want to slug you. It's just people are so reactive. It's really sad.
That happens to you a lot?
I've done it just to demonstrate defensiveness. I'll just be talking to somebody. I'll just shove somebody. It's like they're like that. Yeah, it's exactly the way we are. We're just like that. And it's sad. You know, our reactance is a big thing.
I bet that's a wonderful conversation.
It has led to some great conversations. Yeah, it has. I feel like that when someone's being too reactive and too defensive, I'll just show them what defensive looks like. I've never been hit yet.
That's good.
I don't think you really say that. Okay. I don't think you mean that. I look at your eyes going, I wish you'd get punched just once. It would serve you right. The spotlight effect.
What's that?
It's another bias. It's you overestimate how much people notice how you look and act. You overestimate how much people are looking at you.
Wow.
As they say, when you're worried about what people thinking of you, mostly they're not.
I realize that. Do you think a lot of people have that?
Most people are much more concerned about themselves than they are about you.
That's true.
I know. Absent overt prejudices, people generally want to like and get along with you as it gives them validation too. But yeah, I think we all overestimate that. So that's why we're thinking, I bet Brad's thinking this because I'm thinking that of Brad. That's why.
Wow.
Yeah. So instead of worrying about how you're being judged, consider how you make others feel. They'll remember this much more and you'll make the world a better place.
Well, that's true. I like that.
I do too. That's what Maya Angelou said that. People will not always remember what you said to them, but they'll always remember how you made them feel. That's good stuff.
I think one of the biggest gifts we can give to people is that sense of acceptance. That doesn't endorse everything that they're doing, but as a person having value, to be able to accept them and affirm that there's value there.
Yeah.
Wow. I think that opens people up.
And compliment people. Just Even though people get defensive when you compliment them, it's amazing how many people, when you just go, you know what I really appreciate about you? Oh, it's just Jesus in me. You know, or they, it's, I'm not worthy
no,
of
no,
any
it's not
nice.
That. If it was that, it'd be a whole lot better.
You think Truman suffered from the spotlight effect? From the Truman
from
Show?
Yeah.
You find out actually everybody is looking at you and judging everything you're doing. So I think he probably suffered from it. Just World Hypothesis is next. We've already beat that
one
to death.
Yes, I'm for it.
In-group bias.
In-group?
You unfairly favor those who belong to your group. There you go. You got that one in spades.
Oh, thank you,
we presume
Mr.
that.
Accuser.
Oh, I'm sorry. I think that was a spotlight effect. It says, you presume that we're fair and you're fair and impartial, but the truth is that we automatically favor those who are most like us or belong to our groups. That's why it's hard to have any kind of reasonable political discussion anymore. Everybody's got their in-group.
Do you know many people who actually are objective?
No.
Yeah, I was going to say, I honestly don't know anybody.
But I'll tell you what will help you. This is a chapter in the book we're working on, Language of Healing.
Uh-huh.
From in-group bias, then you got to realize, who's my in-group? So who is in my out-group? Who are people that are not my in-group? And if you recognize who those are, and then pursue relationships with people in your out-group, find out what they think, and find out. And suddenly you find your ideas broadening. You're not just locked in on the same voices to the choir that you've heard all your life. And I think there's ways to be less subjective, but is any of us truly objective in the end of the day? I think we deceive ourselves. I'm sure there's one of these in here that will say that that's a problem.
Yeah.
Because we process life through how it affects us and people I love.
Yeah. And I just sort of feel like, you know, so when, I'm just being objective. It's like, no, I don't know the human being that really has that capacity. You can aspire to try to be less subjective. But I don't know anybody that really is so outside of themselves and free from all of their bias and preferences to truly see something from an objective point of view. I mean, like, you need God to be able to come close to that.
And even then, it will not be easy.
Right.
Yeah, well, that's why I think there's 24 of these. I don't think most people – the value of this conversation, this last week and this, I think is to – help people be aware that when I think I'm being so unbiased, there are 24 of these that they've identified that we're laughing about them because we see how they affect how we deal
right,
with life.
Right, and I can't imagine there's only 24.
And it's good to have a, you know, occasionally focus on it and realize, okay, I could be able to, you know, I'll never hear anybody talk about a just world again without thinking of the just world hypothesis. I do too. I want a world that's fair, but we live in a world that is completely unfair. For the most part, and benefits the those who have advantages, for sure. The fundamental attribution error.
Oh, wow.
I don't even like this name of that one. The fundamental attribution
error.
What
is it?
You judge others on their character, but yourself on the situation. You haven't had a good night's sleep. You know why you're being a bit slow. But if you observe someone else being a bit slow or not have as much knowledge as you, so you might presume they're a slow person. Yeah, isn't that sad? Fundamental attribution error. We make a, this is just assumption. We make an assumption from the way they are. If people just treat you rudely, the assume is there must be something wrong. Rather than they could be completely distracted. Their rudeness is not coming as a personal affront.
You know, one of the biggest antidotes towards that kind of like the unrighteous judging that we do is
Diet Coke?
Yes. Okay. The measure you use will be measured unto you. I just realized it's like, you know what? We do have a just God who is a righteous judge, and he's not exactly thrilled with all of the unrighteous judgments I make of other people. Oh. Summary conclusions off of instances that I extrapolate to their character. And you're just like, no, don't do that. Because that same measure
that's coming back to you
is going to be measured and you will find yourself failing in the same categories.
Yeah, you will. And you'll find it not even necessarily that God's going to get you for doing that to other people. When you're hard on other people for something, you'll be hard on yourself for that same something. That really is not fun.
It's weird. I do find some people are very hard on others and very soft on themselves. Do you not find that?
I think externally, that's a defense mechanism. I'm more when you get to know them inside as hard.
And you think privately?
Most people will say, I am my worst critic. Living with me is the hardest thing to do. But I agree there are people like you. They're basically psychopathic.
That's awesome.
They have no sense of...
people like you who are psychopath. Nice.
No, gee, I misspoke.
I'm thinking you said what you thought.
This is a fundamental attribution error.
Yeah, there are people like you who are psychopaths. Nice.
No, like you were suggesting. I left out the word suggesting, but I get the humor in it. It's actually funnier the other way. But okay. No, I think there are people who, yeah, they don't care what other people think in that sense. So, but I think most people are their harshest critic. I think condemnation, guilt, I think all that comes from inside. That's not even, you know, it's not from God, we know. I don't think it's always from the devil. I think it's a lot of just, we're hard on us.
Huh.
And judge our character. And so, yeah, I do think that happens the other way too.
I do think that just the general reality of shame permeates so much of this.
Yeah. Does.
I don't want to take us off track, but how in just...
It's twice you've said that.
Yes, I
know. And then you do.
But I'm thinking about something out loud.
Why?
Yeah, exactly. How do you get rid of the shame bias that so permeates things? It's like, because I sort of feel like until that gets pulled off, it's really hard to not be consumed by all this.
It has to be a Jesus thing, right?
Yeah.
I think it's what the cross did. The cross removed our shame.
I know, but take it into the practical tangibles of, I know Jesus died on the cross. How does that get rid of my shame?
Rid of your what?
My shame.
I'm not sure that's what you said the first time. I have to go back and look at the tape.
You're slow. I still need coffee.
You haven't had coffee?
No, I didn't. I woke up late.
Wow. Oh,
well, I got here on time, though.
A little late, but it was only a minute or two. That's really, you're never a little late. Oh, that was amazing. How do you get rid of it? You know, I just know, I this sounds horrible. I can't think of anything for which I feel shame. I don't. Not anymore. I used to all the time.
I know. And that is awesome.
And that doesn't mean...
How does that transact? Because there are so many people that cannot say that.
I know. But I don't think here's step one, two, and three. I don't. I think... When being won into his love takes care of that shame. The more of his love we have, the less we feel. Because my shame was directed at God. Now, that doesn't mean, when I say I don't have much shame, doesn't mean I can't be in a situation going, I screwed up there. And I feel badly about that in terms of its impact on other people. But I don't have that self-bashing, what a horrible, creepy person you are. I don't have that.
Is that what you would define shame as doing to us? Well, what is shame?
Yeah, shame, I think, in a theological sense, maybe, it's feeling unworthy of God's love.
Okay.
But in a way, it's, I think, embarrassment, when I get embarrassed.
See, that's almost a central doctrinal tenet for a lot of people.
The shame is what I need
unworthy.
To feel.
Oh. We're unworthy. I mean, it's like they revel in that.
That's why Chuck Colson hated the shack, you remember? When Isaiah confronts God, he's undone with his own sense of unworthiness, and Mac wasn't, so we know this can't be a godly book.
That's why it's a central tenet for an awful lot of people is, how unworthy we are. And I'm just going like, the more you live there, the more consumed by all of that you are, and I don't see any freedom.
No, I don't. That's why the one thing the cross came to do is that now inside a relationship with him, without shame, I begin a journey with Jesus that's not motivated by my own sense of unworthiness.
So how does the cross remove shame? No. I'm trying to take it out of the ether into the practical for people, because I think they hear, oh yeah, Jesus died on the cross, and it's like everyone says, oh, I know. And I'm like, really? Do you really know? Do you really know what was solved there? Has that really become revelation of freedom on the inside?
Well, that's how, right? It's got to become a revelation.
Yes.
Jesus took our sin and shame into himself, and the love of God consumed it there. It no longer exists in God for us. And the sooner you get to realize that God transacts with you, Jesus does a work in you where you realize he's judging, in the language of the movie of the shack, God's judged you worthy of love. So you don't have the right to keep feeling unworthy of God's love because he's deemed you worthy of it.
That to me is the complete disconnect with religion where I'm just going like, when someone's up there and, oh, Lord, we're so unworthy, I'm just going like, what are you talking about? That is not the heart of God towards us.
or that one hymn that talked about such a worm as I.
Yeah.
Yeah, oh, groveling. It's somehow, I mean, because we get it from Isaiah 6. We get it, you know, wicked man that I am, I come from a generation of unclean people and all that. But that's a pre-cross engagement with God. That's what people need. People don't understand who teach religion. They think that's how you should feel in the face of the Creator instead of the Hebrews 10, to boldly come to the throne of grace. Not boldly in the sense, not arrogance, just I belong here. God's made a way for me to be here. I belong here. I belong with him. And there's still crud in my life, but it's not personal shame. It's brokenness from sin. And yes, I want God to heal me, cleanse me, make me, teach me to live differently in the world. I want that.
Yeah, because I end up going like, I mean, there's moments where there is genuine conviction where I'm going like, ah, what am I doing? But there isn't that sense of, oh, I just absolutely suck. You just go like, no, wait a minute. The fact that I'm being convicted in an arena that has a measure of specificity is in fact evidence that I have a God who cares about my transformation.
Yeah.
And I don't feel unworthy. I feel focused on. And I'm actually glad to have I sort of feel like repentance is kind of like a gift. If I'm not amply convicted of something, I don't turn from it. I need God's help to show me, hey, stop. Yeah. That leads to nowhere. I need wisdom and help to see those things because when I don't, I continue to do them.
Yeah.
And so as God shows up in those spaces, that really is not evidence of, oh, you know, I am so unworthy. It's like, no. It's evidence that he loves you and he's dealing with you. That's that. I mean, most people interpret correction as rejection.
Yeah.
And I'm sitting there going like, oh, it's evidence that he's at work in me. That's a profound change. I don't have to run from that. I can actually run to him and go, oh, please do more.
Yeah. Can you imagine what it is to negotiate a broken place in your life with shame, which makes you want to hide it and cover up for it and accuse other people, deflect, you know, it's all that. And to deal with stuff in my life, because I've dealt with people in relationships that are shameless. And it's very easy just to own our stuff, ask forgiveness, get on with it. But where there's shame, where somebody's just feeling shame, they can't ever admit what's broken in them because it will devastate. So they're always on the attack. They're always, you're the bad guy. And I don't know how to work through that. I can't. As long as you're shamed, and I think God wrestles with that. That's why the cross, the shame, the wicked man that I am, but that doesn't help me get where I want to get with you.
Yeah.
It doesn't help me. And it certainly didn't help us. So let's let him go there. Hey, we got to do this. We'll be
okay.
Doing
sorry.
This
I thought that rabbit had some fur.
We'll be doing this all summer long. The halo effect, how much you like someone or how attractive they are influences your other judgments of them. Why do you think this is funny?
The halo effect. I get that.
Our judgments are associated and automatic. So even if we want to be objective and we need to consciously control our irrelevant influence, especially important in a professional setting. You see how much advantage that kind of thinking gives attractive women over not so attractive women in every facet of life. For guys, it's not as big a deal. We're not generally judged on being attractive, right?
We're not.
Well, I've had that problem in my past, but no, I'm just saying overall, I watched my daughter grow up in a different world than my son did.
Yes.
Let me just say it that way. You probably have to.
Yes.
Yeah. The placebo effect. If you believe you're taking medicine, it can sometimes work even if it's false.
What's up with that?
The placebo effect can work for stuff that our mind influences, such as pain, but not so much for things like viruses or broken bones. That's a good one. Give a shot for a broken bone. It's a broken. Says homeopath. This will tick off a lot of people in our audience. This will be fun. Homeopathy. I'm not sure how that said. Acupuncture and many other forms of natural medicine have been proven to be no more effective than a placebo. Keep a healthy body and bank balance by using evidence-based medicine.
Wayne J. qualified at livestream.org.
Do what? Now? I didn't even understand what you said.
I'm just giving out your email for those.
Oh, no, don't do that. Yeah, I was with someone this week, and they start off with, you know, the bias is the American Medical Association wants to make money off people's illnesses. They're really not interested in curing people. And that's what gives credence to all the supplements and stuff that people take, because this really works great, but they won't let us have it because, oh my gosh, I've seen so many people destroyed by that stuff. I even took some stuff that gave me vertigo because it was going to do something for me. I thought, I know better than this, but there.
So you just keep getting yourself ready with Diet Coke.
I had optimism bias about that stuff. And it didn't serve me well. The bystander effect.
What's
you
that?
Presume someone else is going to do something in an emergency situation. This is not me. If I'm in a, you know, so when something terrible is happening in a public setting, we can experience a kind of shock and mental paralysis that distracts us from a sense of personal responsibility.
Yeah. How many more do we have? Else I want to say.
10. Okay. We've only done 12.
I had.
In 2.5 podcasts.
I had a rather significant, like, world leader guy give his presentation.
Why don't you tell
who it
is?
No.
I'm kidding. Political? Religious?
Political.
Okay.
And he was talking about just observations of life, you know, 50-some years of observing, and he kind of just says, you know, I think 80% of the population, they are just followers. And there's 10% that are leaders on this side, and there's 10% on the other side, and it's like they're supposed to sort of contend in it. And I'm listening to this, and I'm just going like, How is that true? How do you know that's true? And he was speaking out of his own life experience of just going like, you know, I think there's probably only 20% of the population that really are designed by God as leaders. And the bulk of folks really are as followers. And I just sat there going like, part of me was grating against that because it's like, I don't know if I believe that. I don't know if that's true. What do you think?
Unfortunately, I think it's true in a human brokenness. I think 20% would be generous. I'd be more 10, but it doesn't mean that's the way people need to live, right?
Right. I think that's where my reaction is. It's like, no, I want to aspire for more.
It's that give us a king effect, right? I'd rather have a king tell me what to do.
I think, that's our fallen defect.
Yeah, it is. But I think it's probably true anecdotally. But I don't think it's God's desire.
Okay, good. That's you're reinforcing my bias.
Oh, there we go. That's confirmation bias. We'll be there in just a minute. So, yeah, I guess that's sad, isn't it?
It made me kind of bummed because I'm going like, I'm not sentencing 80% of the population to a God-created design to be a follower.
And I think most of it, it's this guy, that's why I asked if he came from the political arena, because if you're coming from the political arena, who wants to put themselves through that machine to be, again, my bias, corrupt? And I just think, man, those are the kids that want to go to Harvard and Oxford and Yale and Princeton and get in all the fancy clubs.
It is a perspective of the elite looking at the world going, this is by design this way. And you just go like, huh.
And that's what justifies those schools being such special places to go. We're raising up the next generation's leaders.
Yeah.
And I think I grew up on a farm in California. If I'd have known there was a Yale and Harvard out there and could get in that discussion of things, I probably would have gone, tried to go there.
Huh.
And probably could have. My SAT scores were enough. I probably could have gotten in. But coming from a little farm in California, never even knew that world existed until I was way past it. Okay. The availability heuristic.
What?
What is that heuristic? I don't even know what that is. I have no idea what that word is. H-E-U-R-I-S-T-I-C. Heuristic. Your judgments are influenced by what springs most easily to mind.
Huh.
Your first thought is your best thought.
I think I have this.
Yeah, how recent, emotionally powerful, or unusual your memories are can make them seem more relevant. This, in turn, can cause you to apply them too readily. Try to gain perspective and relevant statistical information rather than relying on your first judgments and emotive
influences. I think they give Ritalin these days for that. ADHD.
And you have that?
No, I don't know. I don't know if I do. I do find myself spontaneously. I'm an out loud processor, yeah. So I can be pulled off the strategic plan.
I've noticed that.
Yeah, I know. I'm sure you have.
Go for longer walks and think things through before you open your mouth.
Yeah, I try.
The available heuristic. And then there's the curse of knowledge. Whoever thought that was a curse? Once you understand something, you presume it to be obvious to everyone.
Yeah, and hopefully you don't treat them like that.
Things make sense once they make sense, so it can be hard to remember why they didn't. We build complex networks of understanding and forget how intricate the path to our available knowledge totally is. I love that. Because I hate the term curse of knowledge, like that's a bad thing. But the idea that you forgot how you got to where you went, so when you try to help other people, you just want to explain the facts. You don't want to help them find their way.
It should be obvious.
Or the famous statement, this is a no-brainer. Yeah. So everybody disagrees with me has no brain. That's how we look at that. Yeah, it doesn't work too well. So when teaching someone new, go slow and explain like they're 10 years old without being patronizing.
No,
that's here. Oh. Without being, you have to talk to somebody like, okay, Bobby, did you bring your pencil? So anyway, helping people. Anchoring.
Anchoring?
The first thing you judge influences your judgment of all that follows. Human minds are associative in nature, so the order in which we receive information helps determine the course of our judgments and perceptions.
Huh.
Anchoring. The first thing you judge influences your judgment of all that follows.
Hmm.
So if I decide you're an idiot, everything you say after that just goes into the file of idiocy, I guess. I don't know if I do a lot of anchoring. I don't know.
I can see how it does impact, but I don't know. That would be – you'd have to be pretty quick to judge.
You can see
for that to have
yeah. You can
impact.
See why not judging would be a virtue. Just don't judge right away.
Why do you think in our culture?
Is that why again?
Yeah, no. Why do you think in our culture we have this huge push to just say, oh, you're not supposed to judge? It's like, no, that's not true. I have to make judgments all the time, but it's like we look at that and that's become a real negative, like, downer accusation towards people who are at times contending for what is true.
Well, Jesus obviously told us, judge not lest you be judged. Hey, that's pretty clear, right? So don't do it.
But in order to make decisions and understand truth, I have to be making judgments all the time.
Make judgments on things without judging people, right?
I know, but I think
you can
that
say
is...
you're wrong without saying you're an idiot.
Totally, but okay. I don't think our culture is making that nuance.
Our culture's not interested in that, for sure.
Yeah, I think our culture is trying to say, hey, don't be saying that's right or wrong. That's judging.
Well, when you throw out you throw out ultimate truth, yeah, then nobody's got right or wrongs. But I believe in ultimate truth. I believe those things are ultimately right, ultimately wrong, ultimately true, ultimately false. I do.
And I think most people, if you press them like with a gun at their face and going like, is it fine if I just pull the trigger? Well, no. Well, then on what basis?
On the basis of my face. Like somebody said, I like this. If somebody who claims that they don't have universal truths, can anyone do anything at any time that you would consider wrong? Can anyone do anything at any time? And then they always say, well, of course, you got a Hitler, you've got, well, then you do believe that things are ultimately good or bad. That is a judgment.
Yeah, yeah, so have some integrity as you apply that in the rest of life.
I think there's a difference between judging things and truth and reality and judging people.
Absolutely. I just think that is getting lost in our culture.
Well, yeah, just by the progressives, probably. Sorry, didn't mean to slap them. Confirmation bias. You look for ways to justify your existing beliefs. I think everybody does this.
Yeah.
Think of your ideas and beliefs as software you're actively trying to find problems with rather than to be defended. That's good. That's a good thought.
Say that again.
Think of your ideas and beliefs as software you're actively trying to find problems with, to debug.
Okay.
Rather than things to be defended. Richard Feynman, whoever he is, said the first principle is that you must not fool yourself, and you are the easiest person to fool.
That, I think, is clearly when Jeremiah says the heart is deceitfully wicked. The problem is not the wicked, it's the deceitful.
Yeah.
Because I can fake myself out.
Yeah, the unredeemed heart, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, because then we get...
Yeah. Okay. I'm with you.
Then there's the Dunning-Kruger effect. I don't even know who Dunning-Kruger is.
I'm done with it.
The more you know, the less confident you're likely to be.
What?
The more you know, the less confident. Because experts know just how much they don't know. They tend to underestimate their ability. But it's easy to be overconfident when you have only a simple idea of how things are.
That's the growth in real wisdom.
The people who know the most are the humblest about it. It's kind of
bad.
They should call it the humble effect. Who in the heck is Dunning-Kruger?
That's a positive.
I don't even know who Dunning-Kruger are.
That's a positive.
Yeah, where it's not positive is you really know what needs to be done here, but because you don't know all the things, you let somebody else who doesn't have a clue do what they want to do. So it can have a negative effect, yeah, if you don't have the confidence to speak up in the environment when you need to speak up. The backfire effect. When your core beliefs are challenged, it can cause you to believe even more strongly. That's kind of like the reactance thing. We can experience being wrong about some ideas as an attack upon our very selves, on our tribal identity. This can lead to motivated reasoning, which causes us to double down despite disconfirming evidence. I've seen that. Mark Twain said this, it ain't what you know that gets you in trouble, it's what you know for sure that ain't so. I love that.
That's good.
Okay.
That's good.
The Barnum effect.
Oh.
I at least know who Barnum is.
Some circus.
You see personal specifics in vague statements by filling in the gaps. What? Because I don't even understand that. That seemed like it was a vague statement. You see personal specifics in vague statements by filling in the gaps. Because our minds are given to making connections, it's easy for us to take nebulous statements and find ways to interpret them so that they seem specific and personal. Oh, this is what gives astrologers and psychics and others use this bias to make us seem like they're telling you something relevant.
Huh.
They say something vague, we make it specific, and then we get sucked into some huckster.
Huh.
So now we're going to hear from all the psychics. You write Brad.
No.
Hopefully we don't have many on here, unless they're open to something different. Two more left. Declinism. They really ran out of good names.
Declinism?
Declinism.
Like you just decline often?
Or declinism.
Yeah.
It says you remember the past as better than it was, and you expect the future to be worse than it will likely be.
That's like your Eeyore-ism.
Despite living in the most peaceful and prosperous time in history, many people believe things are actually getting worse. The 24-hour news cycle with its reporting of overtly negative and violent events may account for some of this effect. I do think that's true. I do think people.
I think that's very much true. That is the lens that is being sort of pulled over everyone's eyes, and we do not see the awesome, amazing, wonderful things that are going on.
Oh, it's true too. I think particularly in the whole culture war thing, Christians always harken back to this better America where the, Judeo-Christian ethics were undergirded the rights of our passage in society. And they look back thinking those are very nostalgic days. But if you're African-American and part of the bias of those days against you or you're Catholic, you don't look back on those days so positively. So I do think that is true. And I think a lot of Christians, the theology is the world's going to get worse and worse and worse, and then Jesus comes again. And so they lose their heart to stay in the process to help better it.
That's incredibly unfortunate. Like when you read through the minor prophets, what is the scenario that's oftentimes
because
presented?
They couldn't get in the major leagues?
The smaller prophets, yeah. the shorter books. There's a common theme. What have you taken away from those?
What do you tell me?
There is.
I'll tell you if I agree.
There's the reality of dark times, but they're always overtaken by light. And they refer to that time as the day of the Lord, where it's like, look, it's bad, but look what comes in response.
Right.
And that's referred to as the day of the Lord. And when you look at the book of Revelation, you know, unfortunately, the way we've translated our English versions of that is when John is saying, and I was on the Spirit on the Lord's day, we kind of like, oh, he had this revelation on a Sunday.
That's right.
And it's, I was in the Spirit on the day of the Lord. And so everything that he's talking about really matches the tenor of everything that's going on as the main motif of the minor prophets that are all prophesying about the day of the Lord. It is that same bit of, yes, there is darkness, but it is all going to be overtaken by this greater tsunami of cascading light that I just end up going like, if we saw the end times through that lens, we would not have this doom and gloom waiting for the rapture bus to come take us out of this as if we're uninvolved. We would have an expectation that, okay, it might be bad, but guess what? God's a coming.
God wins in the end, and yeah.
I think that would greatly affect how we live in the earth.
I think we mostly camp on that Jesus says it wasn't the times of the days of Noah, whatever. So I think that's where evangelicalism is basically camped out. It's just going to get worse and worse and worse. Finally, Jesus is going to show up and fix
everything. So they retreat from doing anything about it.
Yeah, they do.
And I just go like, that's a fatal mistake.
It is. Because I think there are many things in our world, this Declinism thing, you look back, there are many things. Are we more confused about sex and sexual things as a culture? We are. But are there things we're doing for the poor? Are there things we're doing for medically hurting people? I mean, there's so much greater things going on in the world that are increasing. And that's the problem for a lot of Christians. They just see the whole sexual confusion and sexual stuff, and they think, well, the society's worse than it ever was. And yeah, there's a lot to be said for the overtness of sexualism and how it's used to market stuff. And that is true. But there's also true that there's less war, less physical need in the world than ever in human history. There's also some positive things on that score.
Yeah, and our confirmation bias, unfortunately, if I'm looking for the it's getting worse and worse and worse, I don't really see and engage with the things that are going fantastically well.
Yeah. That's why I love that little thing about debugging your own software, realizing the things you think and believe are flawed. You don't know where they're flawed or you would have changed them.
Find the error codes.
But just keep aware that you're going to keep looking for those flaws and you keep growing. Yeah. That's what's going to keep you growing. Once you get into the confirmation bias, you're stuck wherever you were camped 40 years ago. You're still camped there.
Yeah.
Sadly.
That's the error loop.
And the last one.
Oh.
Drum roll, please. Timpani. Bum, 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 bum. This is called the framing effect. You allow yourself to be unduly influenced by context and delivery.
Huh.
We all like to think we think independently, but the truth is that all of us are in fact influenced by delivery, framing, and subtle cues. That's why the ad industry is a thing, despite almost everyone believing they're not affected by advertising messages.
Huh.
Boy, that's true.
But we need context to understand and rightly interpret meaning.
We do.
But this context is sort of talking about the delivery that truth comes to us or whatever comes to us.
Or even
being
just
aware of the package in which it's being presented.
Even just that guy's a really funny and entertaining speaker. So I'm more predisposed to believe what he's saying than to realize
I still have to test it all.
The con men in the world are the most humorous, entertaining people. That's why they get where they get to. I mean, you frame it in a positive, humorous, then people are believe it. And as a public speaker, I know when you tell a good story that's emotive, you can drive points home. But is it a valid point you're driving home, or are you being huckstered into some way of thinking by someone? That's where I think got to keep our eyes open. Say, how's this being framed? And just like the infomercials thing and the investment strategy thing, you can hear a whole presentation that just makes it all the graphs and charts, and it's all being framed to lead you to this one conclusion that may or may not be true. If it's true, great. If it's not true, you've just been suckered in. And that's where the framing and the context is going to be much more fantastic the more untrue the conclusion is, because they're trying to get you to a place that your mind's not saying, I don't think I can buy this. Mm. I mean, I've been sucked into that. I've been sucked into a business opportunity a long time ago that was going to, you know, help me fund my life apart from ministry stuff. And, oh, my gosh. And just hear it, you go, oh, man. And then there was nothing great about it. It was a multi-level, and it wasn't Amway, but it was a multi
It only works for the few people at the top.
It was a disgusting thing looking back, and you go, I got sucked into it from a good friend who gave a really
nice
great
pitch.
Presentation and had these examples from his own life. Turned out 2 years later, he wasn't even in that business anymore, and he didn't sell it. It was a con job.
Wow.
I don't think he knew it was a con job because I don't think he was that kind of guy, but he got conned, and so he was conning because that was part of it. And I got conned. Fortunately, I didn't pass it on to anybody else, so that was cool.
You know, the most – I think one of the most valuable things that has resonated deep inside is that, you know, truth, most fully understood, is a person. And it's like filtering all of these is like, I don't know how to be free from all these biases. I don't. I want to become aware of them. But at the end of the day, I'm needing – to lean on a relationship that I can become secure in and say, hey, you who is truth, can you guide me through this? I think one of the coolest things about the Holy Spirit is that he's been given to us to lead us into truth.
But it really helps. I think what these do is it really helps us to realize how many things, how much we are confident about that may not be true. And the humility of being able to let God and let the Holy Spirit continue to speak into our hearts and not just feel like, well, this is what I believed all my life and I'm anchored my soul in. And I mean, in things like redemption and salvation, and that's fine. Anchor your soul deeply in those truths. But a lot of things, just in the way we deal with life and people, we are often influenced by bias, and being able to know that and talk about it and even be able to say to somebody, I wonder if I've got a bias here. You know, do you see a bias? People often see our biases before we do. And if we're open enough to talk about it with people, then we'd be a lot of light to gain.
Conversations might go a lot more fruitfully if we were able to own that stuff.
Thank you for traveling with us today on The God Journey. You can join this conversation by visiting thegodjourney.com.